This is The Scoop, a weekly regional roundup of stories from remote radio stations in British Columbia. Each week, The Scoop features news created by fellow LJI journalists in the communities of Smithers, Prince George, Nanaimo, Burnaby, and the Comox Valley. LJI is the local journalism initiative, and it's how your best local news is funded on these participating stations. Now, let's see what's happening this week in BC.
Today on The Scoop, a new research study identifies a decades-long decrease in Pacific salmon monitoring. Danny Nesvarandi at CJSF in Burnaby speaks with SFU's Dr. Michael Price. A new exhibit at the Nanaimo Art Gallery re-examines life at Nanaimo's Chinatown. Lauren McKenzie at CHLY Nanaimo has more. And closure of several Smithers businesses has signaled changing consumer habits. I have that story coming up on CICK News in Smithers. I'm Daniel Messick, and you're listening to The Scoop.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvarandi, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. A recently released study from the Canadian Journal of Fisheries and Aquatic Sciences has identified a stark decrease in the monitoring of Pacific salmon populations over the past two decades. According to the study, this erosion in population data greatly decreases the ability of scientists to determine the status of close to half of Pacific salmon populations. To learn more about the implications of this monitoring decrease, as well as why it's been occurring, we spoke with Michael Price, adjunct professor of biological sciences at Simon Fraser University and co-author of this recent study. Please take a listen.
Well, this short abstract of it, without getting too much into the weeds, 2025, when we did performed the research, it was the 20th anniversary of a groundbreaking policy of the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, Canada. They adopted what's known as the Wild Salmon Policy. So in 2005, this was initiated, and it was a new direction for salmon conservation. The conservation of salmon was seen as the highest priority above all other users, First Nations, recreation fishers, commercial fishing. It's conservation first and foremost. And then if there's an abundance of salmon, it goes down the line. So anyway, this was a transformative approach for Canada. And again, this being the 20th anniversary, it was trying to assess, well, how are salmon better off? How are we doing when it comes to adhering to the policy? And one of the primary pillars of the wild salmon policy is to assess the health of wild salmon populations. So we wanted to know, are we gathering the necessary information to assess the health of salmon populations? And that those fundamental data, or the fundamental information really, are the annual counts of salmon returning to spawning streams throughout British Columbia and the Yukon. So this is for Pacific salmon, Western Canada. That was the nuts and bolts of it. Here we are 20 years later. Are we better off? Are we acquiring the necessary information? Have we improved over the last 20 years in terms of the amount of information we're gathering on salmon to assess their health? And in doing so, if we assess them as being at risk, then we can make informed decisions of how to turn the tide, how to improve the state for salmon. So that was the context for this work.
What were the, I guess, specific findings of the research in particular? I noticed that like one major thing that was brought up was this, what is being seen as a decline in monitoring regarding local salmon populations.
So over these last 20 years, yes, so we took it a step further. We looked at, how many spawning populations do we have annual estimates for, annual counts of the number of fish returning to these populations. And then how does that translate into how many populations can we assess their health? And we used a specific index, like each generation, say, of time, and how that's changed. So we can say that the amount of information we're gathering on salmon has declined by roughly a third over the last 20 years. It's been declining steeply since the mid-1980s. So we're now at essentially the lowest level ever. Since 1950, we're now counting the least number of spawning populations than we really ever have. And how that translates to how many populations can we today assess the health of? And the answer is roughly 50% or 55%. So we can only really tell the health of half of British Columbia and Yukon's populations. Those are the major findings. So for the other 50%, we have no idea, really, not necessarily for all of them, but for some of them, we don't even know if they continue to exist. We're no longer looking. That's the most worrying. The next level up from that is we don't know if those populations that we no longer have information for, are they declining? Are they at risk? And on the flip side of that is, might some of these be healthy, but because we don't know that they're healthy, there may be fishing opportunities that are no longer there out of an abundance of caution. So it kind of works two ways. In one way, if we don't have the information, we might be making fisheries decisions in the dark. We may be saying, yes, go ahead, go fishing out in the ocean. And we may be impacting populations that can't withstand those fisheries. But on the flip side of that is we may be saying, don't go fishing because we don't have any information, where actually they may be able to sustain some fishing pressure. So it works two ways. And then third, I'll just finish with saying, and this kind of relates to what's happening today, you know, the federal government is now fast-tracking industrial projects, and several of those industrial projects slated for fast-tracking occur in northern watersheds like the Skeena. So at the, you know, the time that we're trying to bring some industrial projects to fruition, whether these are pipelines or transmission projects or mining projects, we're losing our ability to assess whether these projects will actually harm salmon or not. So we're essentially making a lot of decisions in the dark, and that does not bode well for salmon.
Why do you think that this has been occurring? Like, what has led to this decrease in monitoring and tracking of Western salmon populations?
Largely, I would say it's a lack of priority. So it's not because of lack of funding. And we can see that because in 2021, the federal government injected almost $700 million new money into a specific initiative for salmon conservation. And the activities that they've undertaken over the last 5 years, they basically spent all the money, $700 million. Salmon monitoring was not a priority. Enhancement was, harvest transformation, or like the buying back of fishing vessels or aquaculture. These things have been prioritized, whereas salmon monitoring hasn't. So it's basically a lack of priority. I don't know if it's a lack of understanding of how important this basic information is. I can't see that being true. I think all salmon biologists recognize the need for information to assess the health of populations, but maybe the upper echelon of, you know, into the politics, they may not be interested in monitoring, interested in knowing how healthy salmon populations are, because they need to act on it. If they did know how healthy these populations are.
Mm-hmm. I noticed in part of the article, you're quoted as saying part of the solution would include strengthening indigenous-led and community-based data collection. I was wondering if you could explain that a bit, what that would entail, what that would look like, essentially.
Well, it's starting to happen. It's been happening over the last number of years, probably kickstarted with the wild salmon policy and the recognition that DFO can't do it alone. But also knowing, you know, given the remoteness of many salmon spawning streams on especially the central and north coast of British Columbia and into the Yukon, there are many indigenous communities that reside in these remote areas, and they have been active stewards of this resource for thousands of years. So it's really a transferring back of that stewardship to local communities. So that has been happening, where local indigenous communities are starting to are doing some of that monitoring. They are going into salmon spawning streams and counting them. So it's more of that. It's transferring more of that stewardship to local indigenous communities, allowing them, providing them the capacity to do that. And it does two things. One, it enables salmon to be monitored in some of the remote regions of our province. But two, it also provides capacity for often underemployed communities. So there's a, I feel there's a real missed opportunity beyond salmon conservation and turning the tide and ensuring that salmon populations don't decline and become extinct, which some are and some have. It's also empowering local communities to, again, be more active stewards and, you know, be that primary steward of the resource.
One other question I had was regarding the specific species of salmon that need monitoring and determining of where their health is at. One specific type of salmon in particular that was referenced was sockeye. And I'm wondering if there's any specific reason as to why the health or the data around the health of sockeye is something that is lacking in particular.
Well, it's interesting. Sockeye salmon have been, like, when commercial fisheries began in the late 1800s, sockeye were the primary species. The red flesh was the first to be marketed. They could put it into cans. People recognized that. It actually took a while for pink salmon and chum salmon, who have much lighter flesh, to be accepted by the public and marketable. That didn't happen until the war years, when they literally needed to provide food for the troops. And so part of my PhD research used the scales from sockeye salmon dating back to the early 1900s. So in some ways we have the most amount of information on sockeye salmon compared to all other species. But when it comes to monitoring, the challenge with sockeye is they're the one species that those spawning fish literally go back to the place of their birth. They, what we call, they don't often stray. They don't often go into other rivers that they were not born in to spawn. So they have very high genetic uniqueness. So almost, if you can think of it as every spawning stream has a genetically unique sockeye population. Whereas other species like chum salmon or Chinook salmon or pink salmon, these populations consist of, at times, hundreds of spawning populations. So because they stray so often, they have a lot of genetic mixing. So sockeye salmon actually have the most number of unique populations. They're actually called conservation units. It's a different level of population. So a sockeye conservation unit, again, may just have one spawning population, and there are some 200 of those, say, in the province. Whereas a given Chinook salmon conservation unit might consist of over 100 spawning populations. So it's much easier for us to, and this is the way it was a conservative way that we assessed whether we have enough information on a given conservation unit. As long as one spawning population for Chinook within a conservation unit that may have hundreds of spawning populations, as long as one was counted, we said, check, you have enough information to assess its health. That's, you know, we could go into the weeds, which we didn't, about whether that's adequate or not. We don't. But that's why for a lot of these sockeye conservation units, they're in very remote places that are admittedly difficult to monitor and count. And so it's actually, that's what, you know, kind of, if we say there's a lack of monitoring for sockeye salmon, that's why. Proportionately, that's not true. Really, they're about even across all species. It's not that we're targeting sockeye salmon and saying, let's not, you know, count those fish, because actually they still remain an economically, but also culturally important species. Like to First Nations, they're right there at the top. Chinook and sockeye for First Nations, particularly in the Skeena where I'm at with the Wet'suwet'en, those are the two species that elders wish for. You know, coho are not desired. So there is a priority to monitor them, but they're difficult and they're genetically unique. So there's a lot of them. So proportionally, they're the least monitored.
This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM.
This is a Sichuan news update. It has been over 6 decades since the last remaining Chinatown in Nanaimo was destroyed by a fire. Now, a new exhibit reflects on what was and what is now. Bleached by the Sun, Perspectives on Chinatown is the newest exhibit at the Nanaimo Art Gallery, examining the legacies of Nanaimo's former Chinatowns through artwork and photographs. The exhibit shares the history of Nanaimo's 4 former Chinatowns. The first Chinatown was built in the 1960s, prior to Nanaimo's incorporation as a municipality, following a coal mining boom in the area. 3 other subsequent Chinatowns were built throughout the downtown area, until the last remaining one was obliterated in a fire on September 30th of 1960. Photographs by the late Kim Jung and Fred Herzog, as well as paintings by the late Betty Wong, share images of the Chinatowns that once stood and lives lived in the community. The exhibit also features 3 contemporary artists, Charles Zong, Jackie Wong, and Karen Tam. These artists incorporate modern-day perspectives of the community and remember the past. The exhibit is curated by Jesse Birch and Imogen Lim. Lim is a retired Vancouver Island University professor who taught in the Department of Anthropology and the Global Studies Department. Lim and Tam came down to the CHY studio to talk about the exhibit. Tam has 3 textile works in the exhibit, looking at the historical aspects of Chinatowns.
I'm from Montreal. So thinking about Montreal's Chinatowns and just Chinatowns overall across the country and how they've changed, some have disappeared, right? Others have moved to other locations in the city they're in.
One of her pieces was made during a rise in anti-Asian hate crimes during the COVID-19 pandemic,
where I had silkscreened onto satin drawings that I had made during the pandemic of the anti-Asian attacks, whether it was in Vancouver or Montreal or Brooklyn or Melbourne, and then having them next to other drawings I made based on historic photos of, say, the San Francisco earthquake that destroyed Chinatown, or the fire in Nanaimo that destroyed one of the Chinatowns.
Lim says this exhibit intertwines the past with the current day, with each piece carefully picked to tell a story. Lim highlights the German-born photographer Fred Herzog, who was made popular for his photographs of Vancouver's Chinatown throughout the 1950s and 60s.
There's 4 images for Herzog. And like I said, there's this emptiness and there's this solitary figure in each of those streetscapes. And then you have 2 doorways. And I think the doorways are interesting because I'm also thinking, you know, like when I just saw Karen's runescape installed, it's curtains. So it's like it's an opening. And then you have these doorways and it's opening. So what is it opening to? Is it opening to the future, opening to the past? So there's these things that are going on.
Lim says following the 1960 fire, the memory of Chinatown has faded, with many Nanaimo residents even forgetting that the city once held four.
We're in the year 2026. So if you think a generation is 20 years, three generations have passed, right? So what does it mean to the memory of a particular place? Because I know people who have moved here, they don't even know that there had been a Chinatown. The other thing about not knowing that there had been a Chinatown, again, this is about context. So before the CPR had Vancouver as the terminus, Victoria had the largest population, then New Westminster, then Nanaimo. Nanaimo actually had the third largest Chinatown pre-1885.
Lim says if you look at any Chinatown, whether it's in Nanaimo, Montreal, or Vancouver, most of the Chinatowns were built in the periphery of the community, pushed to the side.
And so, of course, as the city grows, they encompass it. And then it's like, oh, Chinatown's kind of in the way. Well, let's have a little urban development. And then, poof, gets pushed out. And then if you're not a history buff, or if there's no plaque or nobody talks about it, you won't know that this had been an actual community.
Lim brings up how many people may not even realize that historic Chinatowns were based on anti-Asian legislation. Chinese and Chinese-Canadian people were heavily segregated in British Columbia, socially, academically, economically, and politically throughout the 1800s and the early 1900s. In 1923, the federal government enacted the Chinese Immigration Act, commonly known as the Chinese Exclusion Act. The act was passed on July 1st of that year, resulting in a halt in Chinese immigration into Canada. Chinese-Canadian residents were torn away from families back in China, and the growth of the community slowed due to the lack of Chinese-Canadian women in the country. The act was in place for 24 years before it was repealed in 1947. When Chinese immigrants were finally allowed to apply for citizenship in Canada. Chinese Canadians weren't allowed to vote until 1949.
I think talking about Chinatown can be, there could be a conflict of opinions as to good and bad about Chinatown. So the one thing about Chinatowns, I would also say, besides the fact that you had clusters of people of Chinese ancestry there, is when they had those restaurants, they were open to business for everyone. So I know that in Vancouver's Chinatown, you could go into a restaurant and Indigenous people, no problem. Black, no problem. But think about other parts of the city. Would they be welcome? No. So Chinatowns were welcoming of everyone. And part of it is because they knew what it meant to be discriminated against.
Tam says no matter how somebody looks at Chinatown, Chinatown is the heart of the community.
Chinatown is one of those places where you can gather. And I'm just thinking, you know, Montreal, Chinatown, for example, it's quite small. It diminished in size due to urban development. But you know, there for seniors living in Chinatown, it's really important for them because they can be served in their own language, culturally specific foods, the Chinese newspaper, so they can get all the news, the doctor, the pharmacy, the banks. Everything is walkable as well. So that's really important.
Bleached by the Sun, Perspectives on Chinatown will run at the Nanaimo Art Gallery in downtown Nanaimo until March 22nd. A special opening reception will take place this evening from 7 till 9 p.m. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
Today on CSEK News. Over the past several months, a number of Main Street businesses have closed up shop. Mountain and Meadows, as well as Sadaz Lingerie and Rejar, have all closed their doors, citing growing challenges in business and especially retail. Not surprising, given that around 60% of Canadians now purchase their clothes online, according to Canadian fashion statistics last year. But what does this mean for the future of retail business in Smithers? Today, we speak with Trevor Morris, president of the Smithers Chamber of Commerce, about what he is hearing from members of the business community and how the Chamber is trying to advocate for local business in Smithers. Stay with us.
I'm the president of the Smithers District Chamber of Commerce here in Smithers.
Great, Trevor. Thanks so much for being with us on CICK News. As I had mentioned, we've seen a number of businesses close up shop recently here in Smithers. Two in particular on Main Street in the downtown were retailers and cited some developing and growing persistent challenges for retail, but also business in Smithers. What can you tell me from the Chamber's perspective, what you have been hearing from some of the members and the trends that you've seen develop over the last number of years?
It's definitely more than one or two things. There seems to be a number of factors involved here, one of them being crime in the downtown area. Some people blame that on the growing tent city, but that's sort of an across the country issue here. And another one being the high rate of inflation and the cost of things, where it can make the customers essentially have less money to spend, but it can also mean that the businesses themselves have to spend more on certain things, including staff. And so wages going up, that's a huge cost. Another challenge I've heard in terms of staff is it's hard to get people to move here for a few different reasons. It's hard to find a doctor. It's hard to find somewhere to live, and it's very hard to find childcare. So those are a few of the reasons, and yeah, I mean, once in a while I hear something about, you know, town regulations. That's a challenge as well, but I think for the most part, it's the other ones that I mentioned there.
I guess, Trevor, for those that are unaware, you know, what businesses have you heard that have closed up or moved on in the past few months here in Smithers?
Let's see. I mean, we put together a lot of support in terms of marketing for people or events. But yeah, like I say, just doing what we can to reinforce. There are many programs that we run in terms of promoting local shopping as opposed to online. Yeah. But yeah, like I said, for the most part, it's for existing businesses here or new businesses as opposed to, you know, trying to attract businesses from out of town.
I know. I know. Recently, as you do every year, there was a business walk in Smithers, and as you mentioned, to, you know, support businesses, but also to inform people about, you know, which businesses are in town. What did you discover, and what was, if anything, new on this past year's business walk?
Well, I would say that compared to previous years, it does seem like, you know, things are more difficult. Business owners have kind of less time in general even to chat about these things because they're doing whatever they can to keep things running. It's a tough time a little bit for, well, especially retail business owners for the reasons that we outlined. But, yeah, I mean, I think that there was definitely an expression of a want for more support, but not just from a municipal standpoint, but from provincial government and federal government as well, in terms of encouraging people to run businesses. And, you know, taxation is always a very large concern as well.
That's it for this week's Scoop. Catch us next week, Thursdays at 12 p.m. in Smithers, Thursdays at 4 p.m. in Burnaby, Fridays at 8 a.m. in Nanaimo, and weekdays at 7:30 in Prince George. The Scoop was made possible by funding from the Canadian government and the Local Journalism Initiative, a Community Radio Fund of Canada initiative.